Welcome to PostView.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for standing by, and welcome to the Immigration Policy Center press briefing. I will now turn the call over to your moderator, Angela Kelly. Please go ahead.
Thank you, everyone, for joining us this afternoon. We have what I think promises to be a very exciting lineup of speakers and very interesting research that we want people to share with folks. And for those of you who are in front of a computer, I would direct you to immigrationpolicy.org. And if you go to immigrationpolicy.org, you'll see on our website under featured items the briefing presentation that we're going to be talking about today. Though if you're not in front of a computer, our speakers will be giving you sufficient information that you don't need to be with the presentation in front of you. Welcome, everyone. My name is Angela Kelly, and I'm the director of the Immigration Policy Center, and I am delighted to have with me on the phone today a team of researchers who have been interviewing intending Mexican migrants, both in Mexico and in the U.S., and have some very startling and informative conclusions and findings about how our border enforcement is operating, whether it's working or not, why people are leaving, and whether they're making it in or not, and how. So this is very important research, which should very much inform the active legislative discussion that's been going on for years now, and that will certainly continue in the new Congress and the new administration next year. And we hope that this research can inform those conversations so that they become more about solutions and less about sound bites. So without further ado, I'm going to introduce Wayne Cornelius. He's the director of the Center for Comparative Immigration Studies at UC San Diego, and he's going to be joined by Scott Borger and Adam Sawyer, who are two of his students, PhD candidates, who will be giving some of their specific findings. After Wayne and Scott and Adam speak, Tamar Jacoby, who is the president of Immigration Works USA, and Kevin Appleby, the director of Migration and Refugee Policy at the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops, will be giving a reaction to the findings and putting it in the context of what's going to happen on Capitol Hill. So let me, without further ado, turn it over to Wayne. And let me just remind people who just joined the call that if you go to immigrationpolicy.org on your computer, on the Internet, that you'll be able to see under featured items the briefing presentation. There's a PDF. Thank you very much. Wayne?
Thank you, Angela. We are now 15 years into a strategy of immigration control that has overwhelmingly emphasized border enforcement rather than worksite enforcement or other forms of interior enforcement. Since 2005, the Mexican Migration Research and Training Program at UC San Diego has been documenting the effects of this strategy on the actual behavior of migrants. To do this, we have studied high immigration communities in four different Mexican states: Jalisco, Zacatecas, Oaxaca, and the Yucatan. We have interviewed well over 3,000 migrants and potential migrants, both in their hometowns and in the U.S. cities that are their primary destinations. Our most recent study was conducted in a town located in a remote region of the state of Oaxaca. And most of what we have to report today comes from that most recent study, although I'll also be presenting some findings from the preceding three studies done in other states. This is the first public presentation of our findings from the Oaxaca study. People have been migrating from our research site in Oaxaca to both Mexican destinations and to the United States since the 1970s. But for the last 20 years, the vast majority of migrants have gone to the U.S. And most of the migration to the U.S. has actually occurred during the period of tighter U.S. border enforcement since 1993. Today, almost 37% of the adults in the town have migrated at least once to the U.S. On their most recent migration, 87% of them were undocumented, and among those whom we interviewed in the United States, 60% are currently undocumented. They would vastly prefer to come legally. When we asked our interviewees last December whether they would participate in a new guest worker program if the U.S. Congress were to approve one. Two-thirds of them said yes, and the remaining one-third were unlikely to migrate because of age. Well, does border enforcement prevent illegal entry? That's the key question that we have tried to answer in our field studies during the past 4 years. Our interviews delve deeply into what migrants and potential migrants actually know about the obstacles and the risks of clandestine border crossings. More than two-thirds of our Oaxacan interviewees thought that it is very difficult to evade the Border Patrol. 9 out of 10 believe that it is very dangerous to cross illegally. And nearly a quarter knew someone who had died trying to cross the border. But knowing that clandestine entry is very dangerous, knowing that evading the Border Patrol is very difficult, and knowing someone who died attempting to cross the border are not useful predictors of who will migrate and who will not. This kind of knowledge and perceptions does not differentiate between those who intended to go to the U.S. in 2008 and those who planned to stay home. And when we did a multivariate analysis of these same data, we found that perceptions of border crossing difficulty and danger had no statistically significant effect on the intention to migrate when we controlled for a variety of demographic factors. So in sum, seeing the fortified border as a formidable and dangerous obstacle course does not deter would-be migrants. The wall that we are building along about one-third of the U.S.-Mexico border is not very intimidating to them. Fewer than 6% of our interviewees from Oaxaca saw border fencing as the most important obstacle that they would face if they crossed the border this year. In fact, considerably fewer than those who were worried most about being assaulted by Mexican bandits. Most importantly, we find that the obstacle course that we have built at the border does not prevent illegal entry. In all of our 4 studies, we have found that fewer than half of migrants who come to the border are apprehended even once by the Border Patrol. The apprehension rate in our studies varies between 24% and 47%. And of those who are caught, all but a tiny minority eventually get through, between 92% and 98%, depending on the community of origin. We've also found that the eventual success rate has remained remarkably high throughout the period of tighter border enforcement. The success rate among our Oaxacan migrants is virtually the same for those who crossed most recently before 1995, when the border was largely unfortified, and those who crossed in the most recent period, from 2005 to 2007. In other words, border enforcement seems to have made no appreciable difference in terms of migrants' ability to enter the U.S. clandestinely. For a broader perspective on all of this, I'm going to turn now to Scott Borger, the economist on our research team.
One of the innovations of our research and the Mexican Migrant Field Research Program surveys, its contribution to the knowledge about the aggregate flows of undocumented migrants by being able to estimate the number of apprehensions by the Border Patrol for each migrant that successfully crosses the border in a given period. In our surveys, we ask individuals whether they have ever migrated, what their documentation status was at the time of crossing, the number of times the migrant was apprehended on a given trip, and whether or not they were successful in crossing the border. This allowed us to calculate in a given year the number of apprehensions for each migrant that successfully crossed the border. The literature has assumed that the apprehensions to migrant ratio would increase with the increased intensity of border enforcement. However, for those of you who have the presentation before you, if you notice on page 23 in the figure there, the apprehensions rate has remained quite constant over time, while the number of hours the Border Patrol spend on the border has increased exponentially. The microestimate of the ratio of migrants who successfully cross per apprehension, combined with the data on the number of apprehensions at the border, actually enables us to calculate an estimated flow of undocumented migrants over time. The result is a new set of data that can be used by researchers to determine how migrants respond to economic conditions in the United States, economic conditions in Mexico, and policy changes in border enforcement. Using these data, we estimate the flow of undocumented migrants into the United States and put it into the context of what is happening in the U.S. labor market. If you notice on page 24 of those that have the presentation in front of you, notice that recent undocumented migrants, defined as migrants who crossed the border within the previous 3 months in the U.S. labor force, with a 12-month moving average to smooth out seasonal fluctuations. The blue bars are the NBR-defined economic recessions. Here our findings show that undocumented migration clearly responds to changing U.S. economic conditions with steep increases in the flow towards the end of expansion phases of the business cycle and significant decreases during economic downturns. Moreover, the pattern of undocumented migrants responding to economic conditions rather than policy decisions has continued during the border enforcement buildup that began in 1993.
Thanks, Scott. Scott's analysis ends in 2003. What's been happening more recently? Well, we know that apprehensions have been falling since the second half of 2006. Not as much, I might point out, as they fell in the earliest years of this decade. But there has been a clear downward trend since the last half of 2006. Now, the Bush administration would like us to believe that this is happening because of tighter border enforcement. But there are at least four other plausible explanations for the downward trend. First is what we call reduced circularity. Fewer return trips to Mexico are being made by migrants who are bottled up within the United States. They're staying here because of the high cost of people smugglers' fees and also the physical risks of reentry. Fewer return trips means fewer apprehensions. Secondly, increased use of people smugglers, coyotes. If you use a coyote, you have a higher probability of entering without detection. Third, more crossings being made through legal ports of entry. If you cross through a legal port of entry, you actually have a lower probability of being apprehended. There are over 224 million crossings made each year through legal ports of entry along the U.S.-Mexico border. So close scrutiny of those crossers is really impossible. And fourth, the U.S. recession, the current recession, less demand for migrant labor, particularly in the home construction industry, has diminished the jobs magnet. And our research findings lend support to all of these alternative explanations. Hiring a coyote, a people smuggler, was an option chosen by many Mexican migrants even before the current border enforcement buildup. But coyotes are no longer optional. Tougher border control has made them indispensable to a successful and relatively safe crossing. Today, 4 out of 5 undocumented migrants are relying on coyotes to evade the border patrol and reduce the risks of crossing through desert and mountainous areas. And hiring a coyote virtually guarantees success. As the demand for coyotes has risen, the fees that they can charge have risen in tandem. Coyote fees have doubled or tripled all along the border since 1995. Among our Oaxacan interviewees, payments to coyotes have been rising on average by 5% a year, controlling for inflation. So the average fee paid to a coyote by our Oaxacan interviewees in 1995 was $978. By 2005 to 2007, the average fee had risen to over $2,100. And this striking run-up in coyote fees is a direct consequence of heightened border enforcement. Logistical decisions about when and where to cross the border are typically delegated to coyotes. In our study of Oaxacans, we found that the overwhelming majority had crossed in the San Diego-Tijuana area, which until quite recently the Border Patrol had claimed to be under operational control. Nearly one out of five of our interviewees from Oaxaca had passed through a legal port of entry, either concealed in a compartment of a vehicle or as passengers using false or borrowed documents. This mode of entry has increased significantly in popularity since 1995, despite the significant cost. Coyotes are charging upwards of $3,500 for this type of crossing, but it is a preferred mode of entry, especially for women and children, because it reduces physical risk to near zero. In addition to fueling the people smuggling industry, border enforcement has had several other quite important unintended consequences. Fatalities resulting from clandestine border crossings have risen to at least 500 per year. More than 4,700 migrants have died since 1995, and those represent only the bodies that have been discovered. Most importantly, in terms of long-range impact on both Mexico and the United States, tougher border enforcement has turned what used to be a two-way migration flow between Mexico and the United States into a largely one-way, south-to-north flow. In the traditional pattern of Mexican migration to the U.S., most migrants were unaccompanied males who engaged in circular migration. Every 6 or 12 months, they would rotate between working in the U.S. and returning to their hometown for extended stays. Today, some circular migration is still going on, but many more Mexican migrants are staying for long periods in the United States. They are bringing their families with them and putting down roots in this country. Our data show a steady decline in return migration over the last two decades, not just due to border enforcement. There are other contributing factors, but border enforcement has clearly accelerated the trend. So families are reunifying on the U.S. side of the border, leaving their houses in Mexico vacant. Last December, we found that 31% of the housing stock in the town that we studied in Oaxaca had been abandoned by families now living in the United States. Their life in the U.S. isn't an easy one. We found a high level of fear in the Oaxacan immigrant community in San Diego because of local government actions, anti-immigrant actions of various sorts, and media reports about neighborhood and worksite raids. But we found no evidence of voluntary self-deportation. In other words, our interviewees were committed to writing it out. I'm going to turn now to Adam Sawyer, our team's education specialist, to discuss some additional implications of what we've been discussing.
Millions of undocumented students and their parents are now in the United States as an unintended consequence of tougher border enforcement. One thing we have learned in our research is that this documentation status is holding back educational opportunity and progress for this population. Some good news that I'd like to share with you first before talking about this impact of documentation status is that our Oaxacan interviewees overall have very high aspirations. Those who are residing in the United States overwhelmingly cite that they want their children to have a high college education, and students themselves talk of their desire to have a college degree. And there has been good, significant educational progress amongst this group. If you are following along with us on your computer, you now look at slide number 37. This is educational attainment of Oaxacans in Mexico and the United States, listed by age. Those listed in red are our Mexico-based sample, and those in blue are our U.S.-based sample. As you can see, if you're able to follow along, that there has been great progress at each age group for this U.S.-based group. And on the aggregate, we are seeing that the Oaxacans living in the United States have two more years of completed schooling than their counterparts in Mexico. And then by age, we have seen great increases in schooling attainment. Those in the 15 to 19-year-old age group have three times more schooling than their counterparts in the 50 to 59 age group. So there has been significant progress, but even at the highest end of our educational attainment in the 15 to 19-year-old age category, our attainment is only at 11 years, and that is still below U.S. norms. So the question would be, if there's high aspirations and there's been this progress, what is holding back this population, educationally speaking? Well, when we ran multivariate analyses of high school completion, we found, aside from English language proficiency, the most important predictor of high school completion was the documentation status. If you're able to follow along with me now, slide 38 has numbers from our U.S.-based sample of migrants who arrived during their compulsory schooling age. On the left-hand side, we have the percentages of those who have completed high school by documentation status. 76.7% of our documented migrants have completed high school, which is actually higher than the high school completion average nationwide, which stands at about a little over 70%. But if you look at our undocumented group, it is only 31.3% of the undocumented group has completed high school. And to kind of understand what's happening here, if you're able to look on the right-hand side of this slide, number 38, you will see the list of who actually continue their schooling of the migrants who arrived during their schooling years. And of this group, 90% of our documented interviewees did continue schooling in the United States upon arrival, but only 34.2% of our undocumented group. So we are not just talking about a dropout issue in here, we're also talking about a dropping in issue. And when talking to these youths about, the undocumented youths, about their decisions around schooling, they are very knowledgeable about their chances for receiving financial aid. Even in California has in-state tuition available for undocumented students. They are aware that federal financial aid is not available to them, such as Pell Grants. And they also know, even with the college degree, that they will not be able to apply that in the labor force. So they are making a rational calculation based on that knowledge, is what we're finding.
Thank you. To summarize, our research points to the need for comprehensive immigration reform, which we believe to be the best immigration control strategy. If we were designing the policy, we would make four recommendations. First, to emphasize workplace enforcement over border enforcement. Keeping unauthorized migrants out of the U.S. labor market would be both more humane and certainly more effective than trying to stop them at the border. Secondly, we would provide more legal entry opportunities for new migrants through a well-functioning guest worker program and a more realistic supply of permanent resident visas. Third, we would legalize most undocumented immigrants already here to promote integration and to develop their human capital most fully. And finally, we would help Mexico create alternatives to immigration in the places from which migrants come through well-targeted development projects.
Thank you, Wayne. Are you done?
Yes, I am. Thank you.
Okay, terrific. Before we turn to Tamar Jacoby and Kevin Appleby, I'd just like to remind those of you who joined the call late that you can follow the slide presentation on your computer by going to immigrationpolicy.org, and you'll see the PDF there right on our homepage. Tamar Jacoby, President of Immigration Works USA, and Kevin Appleby with the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops, what's your reaction to these findings and putting it in a Washington context for us?
Well, thanks, Angie. This is Tamar. I come from a very different part of the political spectrum than Wayne Cornelius. But, you know, what I find so really telling and important about this research is how it gets us beyond the really stale, polarized ideological debate we're having about immigration in Washington and really nationwide and have been having for a while now, and gets us to focus on the problem. You know, it really helps when you're trying to solve a problem when you really can look at the problem and see what it is. And I'm not sure we've been doing that in the immigration debate for the past couple of years. So I find this really very helpful research. The one thing I think it's important to underscore, and I'm sure Wayne and his team would agree with this, but the implications of this report, although it shows that border enforcement as we've currently been doing it has not been working. I mean, it definitely shows that. Border enforcement as we've currently been doing it does not work. But that doesn't mean that we don't need enforcement. It doesn't mean that enforcement is not a critical part of the answer. And it doesn't mean that no enforcement can work. Those are a lot of double negatives. But the point here is that the conclusion is not to throw up our hands and say nothing would work. That's not an acceptable answer for the United States to say, well, it's a flood, we give up, we have no border, we have no border security. That's not going to do. I mean, just because these migrants are determined to get here. But the point of this study is that enforcement of an unrealistic law is very hard to make work. That's what's not working at the moment. It's not that we don't need to have various mechanisms on the border. It's not, and including some of the mechanisms we've got. It does. We do need that, and we do need vigorous workplace enforcement, but that it's going to be very hard to make them work as long as basically we're fighting the dynamism of the global economy. Unrealistic law. Think about prohibition. Think about a zero-calorie diet. Very hard to stick to a zero-calorie diet. Very hard to make unrealistic law stick, no matter what kind of economic resources you throw at it. And what the research shows is that these workers are coming to the United States to work. The chart that's most revealing, if you only look at one of these charts, look at chart 24, which the researchers referred to, it plots the economic booms and busts of the U.S. economy, and it shows how the migration follows that on a neat line, on a followable chart. So the point is that realistic law that took account of our economy's need for these workers and the way these workers helped grow the U.S. economy, half of the growth in the last several decades was made possible by migrant workers. Half of our new jobs were made possible by having these workers here. A law that took account of that reality would be possible to enforce. Just two quick numbers. About 1.5 million immigrants come every year to fill jobs here. We give out quotas to 1 million. It's as if we were making cars here and had to import the steel, but our steel quotas were a third too low. That's how unrealistic the laws are. So the lesson for policy is that realism could really help. We're not powerless, but there are limits to our power. Let's stop fighting the dynamism of the global economy and come up with some quotas that are more in sync with our labor needs, and then enforce them like we mean it. Last word in closing, the other two most important slides, I think, here, and they really were eye-opening to me. I've been following the research in this field for a long time, and I suspected this was true, but I'd never really seen the numbers and the evidence the way this study points it out. And those are the slides at the end that show what happens to undocumented young people. I mean, it's just terrifying. 65%, something like 65% of undocumented youth never even get to school, and the dropout rate for documented youth is 77%, but the dropout rate for undocumented youth is high school completion rate for documented is 77%, and the high school completion rate for undocumented is less than half that, 31%. Those are just shocking, shocking numbers. What kind of society are we creating where we've got this size of a population, 12 million people, and only 31% of the kids are finishing high school? The word that we ought to be thinking about when we think about what to do about the undocumented is not amnesty, it's assimilation. What are we doing to retard assimilation by our current policies with regard to the undocumented? So those are my main impressions and the things that have struck me the most about this report.
Thank you, Tamar. Kevin?
Thanks, Angie. The U.S. bishops have long favored comprehensive immigration reform, and this bolsters our arguments and shows the reality of what's going on and what the best solution is. The thing that struck me first and foremost about the study is that it approaches immigration from a humanitarian perspective. It gets the human side of the issue. All too often in our debate, it's reduced to economics or social or cultural issues, but this is about human behavior and why people are coming and risking their lives to come and find work in the United States. And I think the answer to the immigration problem lies within looking at the views of those who are migrating to our country. It also shows that our system has a high human cost in terms of deaths and abuse by coyotes. When we have an enforcement-only approach, it basically supports the expansion of smuggling networks and coyote networks, as the study shows, that the fees go up and the routes become more dangerous and there's more demand for coyotes. So whenever there's an enforcement action or an increase in enforcement on the U.S. side, there's a corresponding increase in smuggling, which is something we certainly want to reduce. The study also shows that the answer here is not a one-size-fits-all approach. We need a multifaceted approach to this problem. We can't just look at enforcement only. I agree with Tamar that enforcement is an important part of the equation. We also have to look at other aspects of our system. The SAVE Act, which is currently before Congress and has some support, is a prime example of a failed policy. Enforcement is the only thing that's in the bill, and it has an employer verification system, certainly, which is mandated, but without legalizing the 12 million people that are here in the country and allowing them to participate, getting them into the system so that they pay taxes and are identified by the government, it's going to fail because we'll create an underground economy and an underground job system, which will undercut the purpose of the SAVE Act. So, again, this is an example of where Washington's going in the wrong direction. The other thing I would like to point out, two other things I'd like to point out. An important point which was made is that migrants who are coming want to come legally. They want to come through legal avenues so they do it safely, and they want to be inside the law. But our system does not provide them that opportunity. We have only 5,000 permanent visas per year for unskilled workers to come to this country, and we've got 300,000 to 500,000 people who arrive or overstay their visas and are illegal in this country every year. So you do the math. I mean, there's no way for them to come legally. So these findings support a solution that promotes legality as opposed to illegality, which I believe is what the enforcement only approach does. Two other important aspects from the perspective of the church. The findings found that families are now coming. because of the enforcement on the border, because of the separation between families, and they're staying in the U.S. Well, in any comprehensive reform bill, we have to look at the family impact. Pope Benedict, when he was in the United States, spoke to this. He spoke to how families are separated and what the social costs are there. So any bill would have to include the family unity piece. And lastly, the study demonstrates that the long-term solution to this is looking at the root causes of why people are coming. And how can we, as a country, look at creating jobs in those sending communities so they can support their families in dignity? That economic development is the church's answer to a border wall, and it's a humane answer to enforcement along the border. Allow people to stay where they are, and that will eventually solve the problem. In conclusion, I'd just like to say, you know, we're in a dark period in our immigration history because our federal elected officials were unable to find the political will to enact immigration reform last year. Enforcement is now the watchword of the day, and some in Congress and the Bush administration sadly have capitulated to this view and are continuing to pursue these failed policies. Hopefully, a new Congress and a new administration will lead us back to a debate on solving this problem, real solutions, and enactment of comprehensive reform in the not-too-distant future. Thank you.
Thank you, Kevin and Tamar, for your reactions. Operator, could you please give those on the line instructions on how they can queue up for questions? And those who are on from the news media, please listen to these directions and please line up to ask questions. Tabitha?
Ladies and gentlemen, if you'd like to register a question, please press star then the number 1 on your telephone. If your question has been answered and you would like to withdraw your registration, press the pound key. If you're using a speakerphone, please lift up your handset before entering your request. One moment for your first question. Your first question comes from Deborah Buckley with Desert News.
Go ahead, Deborah.
Yeah, I was just curious how you see this all related to the Bush administration's decision to require that companies that contract with federal employers use the E-Verify system?
Well, the announcement that came yesterday is part of a Bush enforcement-only set of proposals that was announced last August, and it's something that could cover as many as 200,000 companies that currently do, that have a contract with the federal government. Something certainly of great concern of us who have studied the issue, because, of course, the databases that E-Verify relies on are the Social Security Administration and the DHS, both of which are riddled, quite frankly, with errors. So the thought of, you know, building an enforcement platform on what is, quite frankly, quicksand seems to be foolhardy. Tamar, I know that you've looked at this issue, and then Wayne, I'd be curious whether you've got comment in the context of your findings.
Well, you know, one of the findings of this study is to point us toward workplace enforcement rather than border enforcement. But again, the critical issue is that if you're trying to the two critical issues. One, if you're trying to enforce unrealistic law, you're going to have a very hard time doing it wherever you're putting the tourniquet, so to speak, or the noose, whatever metaphor you want to use. But the other point is that the problem will be verified. Ultimately, we do want something like E-Verify. Ultimately, the key to getting control is going to be a combination of realistic limits that are in line with our labor needs and what's helping our economy grow, plus enforcement that works. But the problem right now is we don't have that legal flow, and the enforcement doesn't work yet. The enforcement is E-Verify is full of inaccuracies. We're trying to phase it in. We're trying to go from 0 to 60. I mean, we're up into the tens of thousands of employers using it, but the number of employers in the country is over 8 million, and as Andy just said, we're talking about at least 200,000 companies that have contracts with the government. I mean, that leaves out every hospital where they take Medicare, and every doctor's office, and every university where they have Pell Grants. I mean, we are talking about a lot of companies, and to go from a pilot project that's not yet working, even for the people who use it, to that kind of large scale, it's not just going to have implications for immigrants, it's going to have implications for Americans. Americans working in doctors' offices, Americans working at universities, Americans working at these contracting companies, it's likely that up to as many as 10% of them are going to face problems, going to have to go down to see the Social Security Administration in order to get their job. So, you know, the question is that ready for prime time? Is that where we want to go? I think it's hasty. We do want to go there eventually, but mandatory at this stage, I'm just, you know, I don't think there's many people out there who think the program is ready for it.
And then Wayne or Kevin, do you have additional comments?
Well, I think Tamar has said it very well. From the standpoint of prospective migrants, still in Mexico and other countries, they are going to assume that at least in the foreseeable future, that the odds of their being able to find at least one U.S. employer who is not participating in E-Verify are going to be extremely good. And as long as that probability remains high enough, it will be a rational decision for them to try to gain entry to our labor market. So the coverage of employer sanctions, the enforcement of employer sanctions, would have to be nearly uniform across industries, across regions of the country, for them to conclude that, in fact, that they had no realistic chance of gaining employment here.
Thank you, Wayne. Operator, are there other questions?
Yes, your next question comes from Michael Martinez with Chicago Tribune.
Hi, this question is for Wayne and his crew. Illegal entry to the ports is quite a quite an eye-popping scenario. I think most people have a vision of illegal entry through the deserts and in between ports, but coming right through the gate, right through the door, so to speak, is pretty well. Do you have a sense of the trend or a sense of the size of this problem? Because I think most Americans are not familiar with the extent of this sort of entry. And also, could you toss in a comment or two about the National Guard? They're wrapping up their mission down there, and you know, have they? I know that you've said overall that border enforcement just hasn't been effective, but could you give me a comment or two about the National Guard's effectiveness?
Yes, on the trend in entries through legal ports of entry, if you look at slide number 29 in our presentation, slide number 29, you'll see that there was a sharp jump in the proportion of people trying to cross through legal ports of entry. If you compare the pre-1995 period, when we were basically still in an unfortified situation, if you compare that with the period since 1995, there's more than a twofold increase in the proportion of migrants using legal ports of entry to gain entry. And that pretty much tracks with the level of enforcement in the undeveloped areas between the legal ports of entry. This is a mode of entry, as I mentioned, that's particularly attractive for bringing women and children into the U.S. for obvious reasons. And to the extent that we have made undocumented entries not only more costly but much more physically risky, it has clearly increased the incentive to reduce physical risk. And you reduce physical risk by hiring a coyote, a smuggler, to guide you in the most efficient way. But the most foolproof way of reducing physical risk is to go through the legal ports of entry. So there is clearly an upward trend in using that mode of entry. People smugglers offer it now as part of their package of services, but it costs significantly more, upwards of $3,500 a head versus $2,100 roughly for a desert crossing. On the National Guard, if you want to refer either now or later to slide number 15, This reports the results of a question that we asked our interviewees about what they worry most about when they contemplate going to the United States without papers. And the National Guard was mentioned by only 5% of our interviewees as a key source of concern to them. And that's well behind the climatic factors, the border patrol, border bandits, and the physical fencing. So it appears from our data that the National Guard's presence on the border hardly made an impression on people such as those that we've been studying. It's pretty clear that they were not involved in apprehensions. They were working in a support capacity to the Border Patrol, and in fact, most of them were working on construction of the new fencing. So it's really not surprising that the presence of the Guard on the border during the last couple of years has not been a significant additional deterrent beyond the manpower and the fortifications already there.
Thank you, Wayne. Operator, do we have other questions?
Yes, your next question comes from Pat Sapor with Catholic News Service.
Hi, Pat.
Hi, how are you guys doing?
Good.
I wonder if the study did any look at the effects of the reduced circularity on the types of jobs that the immigrants are taking. For instance, I'm trying to get at whether this is a factor in the difficulty that agricultural interests are having in finding workers these days. You know, people, the longer they stay, they're not going home, they move up the job scale ladder, you know, they go from the field to the construction work or whatever. Have you looked at that from an economic perspective in your studying?
I'm pointing the figure at the economist in our group, and he's begging off. We haven't specifically looked at that, but we do find that the proportion of our interviewees who are employed in agriculture in the United States has fallen drastically over the last 15 to 20 years. And most of those who came into the U.S. through the agricultural sector have, in fact, gone on to both services and construction jobs. So this is a long-term trend. The agricultural employers are having at least spot labor shortages, not just because of border enforcement, but also because they can't compete in terms of wages and working conditions with other sectors of the U.S. economy that are much more attractive to migrants.
Well, let me ask a follow-up that might be easier for your economist. I noticed there's some information in the report about effects on the towns, the 30% or so vacant houses, abandoned houses in the town you studied.
Speak up just a little bit. It's kind of hard to hear you.
I'm sorry. Do you have any other, you have the information about the vacant houses in the town you studied. Did you have any other data that shows the draining effects from the reduced circularity on the base towns?
You mean the impact on the local economy itself?
Right, right.
Anybody
I'm striking out
like
on
to guess that?
That?
Sure.
This is Gabriel Lozada, another member of our team.
Well, the local economy in San Miguel is really highly based on immigration. The largest houses in the town being built with immigrant dollars. So there's San Miguel Tlacotepec is a good example of a village where there are not a lot of economic opportunities.
If I can just make another, hi, this is Jonathan Hicken, another member of our team.
Hi, if I can make another note, we asked migrants who are living in the United States if they returned home for their annual fiestas, which is a major tradition in the towns we study, each year there's a large fiesta, and in the past, migrants used to go home every year to attend the fiesta. One of the questions we asked migrants here was whether or not they returned home for the fiestas this year, and the overwhelming majority of our respondents responded that 83%, to be specific, responded that they did not go home to their hometowns for the annual fiestas, which is another indicator of a reduced circularity. Just sort of on an observational note, the town is comprised mainly of old men and old women and young children. So that's an indicator that a lot of the men between 20 and 50 years of age are living here in the United States.
But just not, this is Wayne again, just not going home for the annual fiesta is a big economic hit on the town, because migrants who come back for that typically spend a good deal of money, and it's a major stimulus to retail business in the town, and they're no longer getting that stimulus. Also, the longer migrants stay in the United States, our data show, the less money they remit to the town. And that's partly because they're bringing their relatives to the United States, so there are fewer people left back in the town to support. But over time, the more the circularity of the flow decreases, the more permanent settlement in the United States, the less economic benefit will accrue to the sending community.
Thank you.
All right, we have time for just a few more questions.
Okay, your next question comes from Herman Rosenberg with San Antonio Express News.
Hello?
Hi, Herman.
Hi, Angie, how are you doing?
Great. Go ahead with your question.
It's actually driven more towards the policy side than on the study, sorry about that. But I was wondering if each one of the panelists, including you, Angie, and Wayne, Tamara, anyone wants to weigh in a little bit on what happened with the whole issue of immigration, kind of just being left on the back burner during the primaries, and do you expect that to change at all now as we thrive up into the general, and if it's going to change, how will it change?
Okay, tomorrow I'll let you go, and then we'll go quickly. Go ahead.
Right. Well, I mean, I think actually, you know, if you look at the primaries, what happened was pretty interesting and good from the point of view of immigration. Because remember, you know, people thought immigration was going to be the wedge issue of 08. People were waiting for it to be the gay marriage of this year. And, you know, remember Lou Dobbs predicting that the Republican nominee was going to be the one who was the toughest? Well, it didn't happen. Those guys who tried to demagogue it are history now. I mean, I don't think we're going to have a President Romney or President Huckabee anytime soon, and the guy who was supposedly thought to be absolutely disqualified because of his views on immigration reform is going to be the nominee. And even more interesting than that, take a quick look at the exit polls from the Republican primaries. 60% of Republican voters who voted state after state after state, Republicans, mind you, were asked, what would you do with the people already here, the 12 million already here? And 60% of them were said that they would be for something that other Republicans called amnesty. 60% of them were either for giving people work permits and letting them stay or a path to citizenship. So, you know, immigration is not turning out to be a major electoral issue, but that's not necessarily that bad, because in the polarized climate we have, immigration turning into an electoral issue, you know, I just fear for the results. I think it's going to be Lou Dobbs shouting one thing and, you know, somebody in another corner shouting something else, and I don't know that it's going to be that productive. I mean, yes, the American public is hungry for a solution, and it would be nice if the campaign season could bring that out, but I don't think we want a Lou Dobbs shouting match take the issue, debase the issue into the kind of sound bites that I think we're likely, and emotion that I think we're likely to get in an electoral campaign. So, you know, I don't anticipate that it is going to be such a big issue, but I'm not sure that's such a bad thing.
Kevin or Wayne, do you want to weigh in quickly?
Yeah, I'd like to.
I don't know who's going to raise the issue in the general election, because both Obama and McCain are moderates on this issue. And if McCain tries to raise it, it will only remind a big part of the Republican base that he was, quote, soft on immigration control during the last few years in the Senate. So I think it's probably in the interest of both candidates to downplay the issue, at least in the general election.
I hate to differ on that but I think that both candidates are going to have to address it in one way or the other, because there's a big Hispanic block of votes which are somewhat up for grabs, especially since Senator McCain is the Republican nominee, and they'll play a part in states like Nevada and Colorado and New Mexico and certainly Florida. I think Senator McCain's victory in Florida was in part due to the immigrant vote. So I don't know how although they might, Senator McCain especially, might want to avoid the issue, I think he won't be able to, and he's going to have to, walk a fine line between his right-wing base and reaching out to Hispanics who, although this may not be their number one issue that they vote on, they certainly listen to the debate. Because they have family members who are impacted by it. So if they believe that one party or another is not friendly to immigrants, their votes will reflect that. So I'm confident that whomever is elected, however, that immigration reform, a comprehensive immigration bill, will be considered in their first administration, first 4-year period, because I think they can't avoid the issue. And I think both of them understand that the comprehensive reform is the best solution. It's just, how do you get there politically?
Obama has promised a comprehensive bill in the first 100 days of his administration. The first year of his administration.
Yeah, that's Wayne that just made the last comment. And this is Angie, and I mean, the only thing I would also add to it, this is the issue that, it's the dog that didn't bark, but I think it might be the dog that comes to bite Republicans, quite frankly. And in the special election that was done for Denny Hastert's seat, longtime Republican seat, you had a Republican candidate who was beating up on immigrants. The eventual winner was Foster, who ran to the issue, talked about a comprehensive solution, and he won. And you're seeing that again and again, quite frankly. And so it's not an issue that's playing well for Republicans, and I think it's one that's going to harm them in the long term. We have time for just one more question, and then I'll give my phone number, and so any other reporters who've got questions can just call me directly, and I'll put you in touch with the researchers. So, operator, next and last question.
My last question comes from Charles Erickson with Hispanic Link News.
Yeah, hi. Let me take a look at the coyotes that you're talking about. In your studies, have you come up with any change in who are coyotes, or what emphasis there is with the U.S. enforcement groups to address how to deal with coyotes, or is that just something they pretty well feel isn't possible?
This is Wayne again. We certainly asked our interviewees how they were able to hire a coyote. In some of our studies, we've asked what kind of treatment they received from the people that they hired. It appears from our studies that the vast majority of coyotes are relatively small operations. In many cases, they're extended family, they're family businesses. There are some larger operations, which the Immigration Service talks a lot about, but both our research and other people who have studied the coyote industry shows that it's still a quite decentralized industry, and the costs of entry into the industry are still quite low. So you have a proliferation of tens of thousands of people smugglers all along the U.S.-Mexico border. We have found that the vast majority of them are hired through referrals. It is typically the U.S.-based relatives who recommend or even make arrangements with a coyote to bring their relatives across. So the people who are hired tend to be well vetted, and they are unlikely to abuse their clients, because if they do, they won't get paid most of the money, because the bulk of the payment is paid upon delivery, safe and sound, of the client in the United States, and they certainly won't get any future referrals.
All right, thank you very much, Wayne, and your entire team, Tamar and Kevin as well. I know that there were some questions that we didn't get to, and others on the call, so a question might occur to you. So let me give you two phone numbers that you should jot down, and we can get you in touch with any of the speakers from today's telephonic. You may contact my colleague, Michelle Roslin, and Michelle is at 202 507-7521, or you may contact me, and I'm Angela Kelly, the moderator, and I'm at 202-441-5589. And we please urge folks to contact us, and we'll get you in touch with any of the speakers. I want to thank everyone so much who participated on this call, and have a great day. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, this concludes today's conference call. You may now disconnect.